Ames, the heart of Iowa.
Donald in a Kitchen talks about food. Donald in a Kitchen talks recipes. Donald in a Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donald in a Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctical.
And I'm Donna Priskintas.
We gather here around our kitchen table once a week here live at KHOI Community Radio in beautiful downtown Ames. We talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. Thank you for being with us today. Well, we had a little rain and strange, warmish weather, and we had quite a rain this weekend. And
thank goodness.
Thank goodness for the rain. And also, I want to do a shout-out to the guys from the Rural Electric Power Company, because for some reason, one burst of lightning knocked out the power at the end of our gravel lane. We've got a couple houses out there, and we were distressed with no power. Something about one of those boxes that are out in people's yard, it totally failed. They had to totally take the box and I don't know whether it got struck by lightning or
anybody. But at least they know what they're doing.
And they're fast. They're good. They were right there. Thank you to the Rural Electric Power people. Yes. Well, in between the rain
and the lightning and the thunder.
Yeah. There was some sunshine. I got some fruit trees planted this weekend. Some persimmons. So we will wish them on their way.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. So like the native kinds of.
Yeah.
Yeah. The little guys.
We'll see. The little persimmons.
Oh, boy.
We'll
How see. Many did you do?
Well, five, which I am told they have to have a pollinator. So
right. They're gendered, those persimmon trees.
So we assume maybe. Well, we can't tell. How do you sex them?
You can't tell until they bloom.
Oh,
and they
great.
Have the tiniest little flowers. I know because I have a persimmon tree. And, of course, it can't make persimmons because it's whichever gender it is, without the other, and the lovely Rick Exner has tried for years to graft and so that we would have both genders on the same tree, and we haven't succeeded yet, but we'll see. So
there.
Five will give you better odds.
Well,
than
it'll
me.
Give me odds. So yeah. We'll see. They're out there. I wish
yeah.
them my
here,
best.
Here. I did plant two when I planted them. So maybe you'll do better than me. I lost one. I don't know if it died or I couldn't find it and chopped it down or I don't know. I hope you put markers on yours or something.
Oh, yeah. I always label everything. I'm actually kind of overly potty trained with that. I've got
labels good.
And everything. So we'll see. We'll see. Well, this is a good weekend, though, for the smells of spring. Smells. I always look forward to the smell of plum blossoms, and I got hit in the nose this weekend. They are out. Plum blossoms smell good.
Mm-hmm.
So, plum blossoms, good.
Yeah, little pockets of, isn't that wonderful, yeah.
But then there are those things in spring that don't smell so good. And I also walked out my back door and I got a kind of a whiff and it was really not so good. It smelled like the
chemicals.
It smelled like the pesticide aisle in the greenhouse, in the seed houses or the garden centers that you go to. You just tell. It's kind of this dusty, plasticky smell and the wind died and it just kind of hung there. And I didn't feel like sitting on my deck with the smell of pesticides. So spring in Iowa, be aware, not everything that you smell is plum blossoms.
No, the other thing is I was having my daily hike through the woods the other day, you know, the green carpet of the forest and little tiny, teeny, weeny green things are coming on the trees. You know, I call this the green lace stage. And I'm like loving it. And all of a sudden, what do I smell? It's a park, right? So somewhere off on the other part of the park, everybody's out barbecuing and it all smells like lighter fluid. You know?
Well, we talk about food here and we talk about tastes and think, okay, so it is lighter fluid season.
Yeah, that fire starter stuff, you know? for people who are not patient and don't know how to build a fire with little kindling and and stuff in the middle and then let it grow. And, you know, no, just squirt on the fire starter.
Well, it is exciting. It is kind
of. Yeah, kind of explodes on you.
Right. Well, they do make, to start a fire, those little tubes, those little, look like a coffee can with holes in it, and you light it from the bottom. And
right, but you still have to stuff it with twigs and papers be patient.
And the coals. That's good. That's good. So, but if you happen to enjoy the taste of lighter fluid, so there. There you go. So, Donna and I took a road trip this past week, and on a very sunny, lovely day, not the rainy day, we had a sunny day, we went to Panora, Iowa, and the first thing I ask always is, where is Panora, Iowa? We went to Panora, Iowa to visit the Early Morning Harvest Farm, and that, Panora, Iowa is south and west of Des Moines.
Yeah, mostly west of us.
No, 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 not south. It's mostly west of Des Moines. Mm-hmm.
A little south. Of us, anyway. It's hilly there and pretty.
It's pretty.
It looks different than it does in the middle of the state, so.
Yeah, we went to see Early Morning Harvest Farm, and we visited Earl and Jeff Hafner. They have a grain milling operation.
Yeah, it's a father-son.
Oh, it is.
Multi-generational family business.
A grain milling operation, and they were celebrating the expansion of their on-farm store. They have quite a selection of Iowa-grown products, pretty impressive. There's many good things happening. And we went there because Donna gave a cooking demonstration. What did you do for the cooking demonstration, Donna?
Well, they asked me to talk about how to make your own salad dressing. I'm thinking, okay, how do I make this into a demonstration? It's basically about 5 seconds of, you know, one part of some kind of vinegar, a little bit of mustard, and three parts of olive oil. That's the classic French, vinaigrette. So we talked about that and some add-ins and some fresh herbs and, you know, different kinds of vinegar we did talk about. And we did have, and I had not tasted this before because they carry this in the store, Wilson Orchard, which is from the eastern part of the state. It's an apple orchard, and they sell a apple and fruit orchard. They sell a, they make a raspberry apple cider vinegar, which was a very nice product. If you can find it somewhere, grab a bottle. I'm looking forward to using it on some summer salads. So that was a nice little adventure.
Ah, very good. Very good. Also, I was impressed by, we took a little tour of how the milling works. Now, you wouldn't think about growing wheat or grains much to be milled into flour here in Iowa. I mean, corn and beans. No, we can do other things too. And Early Morning Harvest Farm has been transitioning their farm to organic production. They did that in 2000. But then they also kind of moved around to doing farm-grown wheat, oats, rye, buckwheat, and corn. And this is for people to eat. What a concept.
Well, you know, in an organic rotation, you at minimum have to have three grains. You cannot just do corn and soy, because you have to, you know, you're not using the chemical fertilizer add-ins. So you have to do things where you're building your own soil fertility. And that does require at least a third kind of grain or something to go in there. So buckwheat is common, and Earl had been growing those things for a long time. But we don't grow a lot of wheat in Iowa anymore. So he it all started years ago when Earl was growing buckwheat, and he's saying, Donna, what do I do with this? I had to, my granddaughter, who was in high school at the time, asked him to mill some for her because, you know, buckwheat is, it's not that complicated. It's actually a fruit and doesn't have the same husking quality. So he had some ground, and he said, well, here, take this. I don't know what to do with this. And it happened to be close to the time of the Practical Farmers of Iowa conference. And I said, Earl, why don't you put a couple bags of that in the, you know, it's a fundraising auction to raise money for Practical Farmers of Iowa. And, you know, stick a couple of your buckwheat flour bags in the auction. And he was shocked at how popular that was. And I think he started thinking about it a little bit differently because Earl is one of those guys that, as they, what do they say, grass does not grow under his feet or something like
that. Something like that.
Yeah, he's always up to something. And so he started fiddling around with some little milling stuff, and he and Jeff and his son, and pretty soon he decided he was going to make a grain mill. Now, making a grain mill is a fairly complicated process, and we don't have many or hardly any local mills anymore. You know, everything comes from either Kansas City is a milling center, Minneapolis, of course, a traditional one. But these are large, large mills. And we don't grow, you know, everybody's so into corn and soy. Well, you just send them to the local, you know, co-op, and it's sold off. But if you're a farmer who's trying to grow oats or buckwheat or wheat, then it's up to you to find a market for it, and it's really complicated. So Earl got the idea that he was going to mill his own grains. So he bought a fancy mill. Well, of course, you need a lot of other things to mill the grain. Do you remember the little red hen story? Who will help me grind this grain? Who will help me clean this grain? Who will, you know, so he had to get he got something eventually called a fanning mill, I believe, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And did he say they had to drive to the East Coast to get this thing? And it's big. I don't know how, it's got to be two stories high.
Yeah, two
and
stories.
The size of a big room, maybe 15 by 15. And it's all, this is an old piece of equipment because, you know, the size of mill that Earl has is no longer common, although it used to be. Mm-hmm. So I think he and Jeff had to go to the East Coast, dismantle this fanning mill, and bring it home. So a fanning mill is the thing, it separates, as they say, the wheat from the chaff.
Well put.
Something like that. So, you know, it funnels the grain in, and then there's different screens and this and that. And the thing that they have, and they had to build a barn to put it in too, because of course this is all food grade material, so you have all kinds of constraints in terms of, you know, keeping rodents out and keeping pathogens down and maintaining temperature and yada wada wada. So this fanning mill, though, is a beautiful, it's wood with old belts and pulleys and this and that, and, you know, it looks like something from the Wizard of Oz movie. Or so he's got that, and then he's got the milling room, and then he's got the packaging room. And also, he pointed out on the tour that if you're doing organic certification, then when you pick the corn, for example, every batch, what are those big lugs called? I don't know. They hold how much?
I don't know.
It's a big container that's kind of square, and it's maybe 5 by 5 by 5, a big cube. So each one of those has a batch number, and then the final product has to contain the batch number from which it was derived. It makes it all traceable. And for organic certification, you know, then you have to have the records of what the seed was used and how it was treated and how it was grown, you know, to prove that it is actually following the organic standards. So they have such a complicated operation. It is amazing. First of all, they do cows, beef, and, as we were driving in, we could see all the babies.
It's spring in Iowa.
They're mostly black, some brown, but they're just gorgeous. And I have to say, I've heard Earl call, cause he moves the cows from pasture to pasture. I've heard him do it. He has a lovely tenor voice, and he walks ahead of the cows and he sings, and they follow him.
As they, well, they should.
It's just beautiful. So they do beef, they do chickens, they grow, let's see if we can get this all, buckwheat, rye, corn, I think oats, and wheat. Mm-hmm. And when they first started this milling operation, of course, wheat, there's hard wheat, which is used for bread flour, has a lot of gluten in it. And then there's soft wheat, which is a completely different variety that is used for pastry. You know, now if you just buy like standard all-purpose flour, those larger grains mix so that they have a standard product. So wheat contains ranges of protein. With the harder wheat, I think is a higher protein, higher gluten. So if you're a huge mill, you have, machines that analyze the protein content and you mix one batch of wheat with another to get consistent protein and gluten contents and things like that. But with a smaller grain, you know, it's a lot more guesswork. And at the time, Earl was, I think, only growing the hard wheat, or maybe I've got this backwards, but he only had one of them. He is now growing all of his wheat on his farm. He said he had 400 acres planted in wheat. That's a lot of wheat for Iowa.
Yeah, and you realize this is people food, right?
Right.
This, and it's, well, they sell it in, what, 2-pound bags?
4-pound.
4-pound bags. And it's good. Lots of good things. Some of his flour products are available. They have an online store. They're in stores in Panora and Guthrie Center and Stewart, the New Pioneer Food Co-op in Iowa City, and Wheatsfield Co-op in Ames. It's good
stuff.
Well,
it must be a lots of other places because a new part of their business is they bought a distribution company called
This is good. This
That
is good.
Iowa Girl. Okay. So buying a distribution company mainly means you've bought the refrigerated or reefer trucks, as they're called, and the routes that have the customers and the accounts and ta-ta-ta-ta. And I'm sure they were acquainted with this company because their product goes all over the state of Iowa.
Yeah, no.
And then Earl told me they go to Kansas City and east into Illinois and, of course, all up and down Iowa. Not just their own products, but other Iowa products. And there are more and more Iowa products.
Yes, there are. Actually, we mentioned that the reason they had this open house was they have a store.
On farm store.
And people come and you can find it. And there's one of those green Iowa business signs kind of out on the main road, and it gets you to their farm. Years ago, when they were first starting this, of course they had a little farm store. They had their wheat for sale and their honey. They do wheat and honey. That was fine. But boy, oh boy, they've got all kinds of stuff now. There's all kinds of stuff. There's all kinds of beef and dairy and there's two big refrigerated, cases there. What was it from? Was it Picket Fence and Hanson Dairy.
Yeah, yeah. And some other ice cream companies in Iowa that I had never even seen before. Of course, we couldn't buy ice cream because it would have melted by the time we got it home.
We could have eaten it, but we didn't.
Yeah.
Jams and jellies. Nice thing to walk in and realize what is going on. There's pastas from Iowa. There are
corn chips. Corn tortillas.
Oh, they look good. Salad dressings, mustards, salsas, jellies, honeys, all kind. And they have herbs for sale too.
Yeah, I have to put a plug in for Earl's buckwheat honey here.
There you go.
One of my all-time favorites. It is not easy to find buckwheat honey. Eastern Europeans eat a lot of buckwheat honey and buckwheat, of course. But you don't find it so much here. But I love it, so I bought a big jar of buckwheat honey. Earl claims it's good for your arthritis.
It will. And they have, doing things in their certified test kitchen so they can create things there. They do their own granola and,
They've been making this for a few years. It's a cherry pecan, maybe? It's got a nut in it. Really yummy.
Whatever's good. You can try it. Oh, and Cookie dough.
Yeah, they sell rolls of refrigerated cookie dough made with their flours, of course.
Of course. What a good idea. Now, for those, I suppose people would buy that, and those that like raw cookie dough could just eat it. Oh, goodness. And so, also I want to mention that Jeff Hafner says, all the whole grain is used, and yes, their grain mill that grinds this stuff is made, stone ground.
Yeah, it's stone ground.
Yeah, it's
not all organic.
Yeah.
It's stone ground. We use the flour, and they have a really wonderful corn that they do. Corn flour, which is the most fine grind. Then they have a medium grade one, which is more like grits a little bit. And then they have a really bigger one, which they call polenta, which makes a wonderful porridge or a polenta. I use all of them.
Yeah, Donna turned me on to polenta. I didn't know what polenta was.
Okay, polenta. Let's just say, basically, it's the same as, what did my mother used to call it? Corn?
Mush.
Yes, corn mush. So you take the corn, not the corn flour. That's too fine. That really will get mushy. But you can take, and there are varying sizes of polenta. I really like the large one. It makes a very interesting textural thing. And you do, I think it's 3 parts of liquid to 1 part of corn. So you can use either milk or stock or water.
Mm-hmm.
Then you add a little bit of olive oil or butter. And it's wonderful once it's cooked if you put some cheese to melt in it. I always put garlic in mine. You can put herbs in it. I like a little marjoram or marjoram and basil. And you cook it up, and it's kind of like, I like to cook it like the consistency of mashed potatoes.
Yeah.
The other thing you can do after you've cooked it like that is you can put it in a pan and flatten it out and then bake it and kind of dry it out a little bit. Then you, not too dry, you just, you know, make it form a loaf kind of thing. Then you can refrigerate that and then slice off pieces of it and either brush a little olive oil and throw it on the grill, which is really yummy, or you can just kind of pan fry it a little bit.
Yeah, that's good. You turned me on to polenta. The polenta,
it's corn. We've got corn.
It's corn.
Here, right?
We've got corn.
Doesn't have to be nixtamalized the way, you know, like to make masa for tortillas or, what else do you make masa with?
Matzo meal.
Masa. Masa is when the corn flour has been, treated with lye one of those things. So it makes a different product. Like most of the Mexican, like tamales are made out of masa. Mm-hmm. You can buy that flour already processed. Now, this is not what's going on at Early Morning Harvest. They are using Iowa grown corn and just grinding it.
Mm, very good. Well, I ran across a little news item about the Early Morning Harvest farm, and this is from a few years ago, but their sales really took off during the pandemic. Remember how everybody wanted to make sourdough bread?
Oh, yeah. Cooking at home. Hallelujah.
At home. Finally, why did it take a pandemic? But all of a sudden, more and more people know about Early Morning Harvest Farm. If you want more information, you can go to Early Morning Harvest. Just Google Early Morning Harvest, and you can order online, and they have a nice website. Early Morning Harvest has a lot of good stuff. So we're glad that we got to visit.
Yep, it's always a lot of fun. It is really pretty out there in that part of Iowa.
It is. I'm glad we got to go. And another thing in that store, crickets. You can eat crickets. There's crickets for sale out there. So
Iowa crickets.
Iowa crickets. We're talking Iowa crickets here, folks. Anything you could possibly
cricket
want.
Bars, cricket.
Cricket crunchies, I think.
Yeah.
Okay. Crickets. There we go. You're listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. This is KHOI, and the Donna Lana Kitchen is tasty radio for the heart of Iowa. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. So that'll talk about a local flour mill, and that kind of leads us to flour, and that kind of leads us to pie.
Absolutely.
I think all roads lead to pie.
All right, I have to say here, I want to brag Lana a little bit. She makes a fantastic pie crust.
Practice, practice, practice.
Yeah, well, but you just turn them out for no reason at all. You know, I mean, for me to make a pie, it's like got to be a special deal, and I don't do it that easily. You just like,
well,
I'm turning up, and you always, oh, here's a pie I made.
Well, I happen to like making pies. Other things, you know.
Well, it shows.
So, and I have been making pie crusts for a long time, and yes, I can, I used to make really hard pie crusts. I used to not cook them very well, and they were kind of doughy, but after years and years of having at it,
yeah,
and kind of taking some advice from my mom, I have a basic pie crust recipe that I use for pretty much of everything, and I must warn you that I kind of bake by the seat of my pants, so things change. Like using early morning harvest flour, I found that they're flour that says better for pastry, works beautifully. Now, in that better for pastry flour measurement, sometimes I'll put other things in, but and I didn't know why it worked, but it does. So a basic pie formula, it has a lot to do with technique. It's a dance between keeping things cold, suspending the fat in between the dry stuff, and not overworking things. You kind of have to...
Do you mix with your hands, a fork, or a pastry cutter?
Okay, here is it.
Aha!
Aha! I use a pastry cutter.
I love a pastry cutter.
Yes.
Describe what a pastry cutter looks like.
Is a handle with, it's kind of a U-shaped thing made out of six or eight.
What? Yeah.
Stiff wires that you can cut. It's, yeah.
It's good because it works, and it also keeps the heat of your hands off the flour.
I find the more fussy and more fancy the bakers that write recipes, use your hands and get in there. But you have warm hands. You're going to get the butter way too. I don't like that.
The other technique is to use two forks.
You can do that. But that tends to go all over my counter.
Yeah. The pastry cutter is a lovely little tool to have.
Yeah.
And they're not expensive. They're not electric.
They're very good. A basic formula for pie crust is about a cup and a half of flour and a little salt and 8 tablespoons.
Now, don't use bread flour.
No, you start with pastry flour and eight tablespoons or so of fat, butter, and then add a little lard. I like to use butter and lard in about equal proportions. I like lard. And
And that's probably one of the main reasons that your crust is so good. That and that pastry flour is really nice.
Mm-hmm. Well, here is my pie crust recipe. I actually wrote it down because I really don't write things down, but here it is. So like I said, I use the better for pastry flour. Start out with 1 3/4 cups of flour and save a little bit more for dusting over to the side. Pinch of salt, 8 tablespoons butter, and you can add, depending on if you want.
Do you use chilled butter?
Oh, chilled butter is important, and chilled lard is important.
And do you cut it into chunks before you put it in the flour?
Yes, I do. I cut it into chunks. I just cut it off the stick. And I incorporate that with a pastry cutter.
How much butter? You put the butter in first.
Butter into the flour, yes.
Okay, how much?
8 tablespoons.
This is for a one crust pie or a two crust pie?
This is a two crust pie.
Two crust pie.
And now you can substitute a little bit of that. You can take out the 8 tablespoons and maybe make 6 tablespoons butter, 2 tablespoons lard. It's whatever.
Okay, so 8 tablespoons total fat.
Total, yeah. Yeah, for that much. That seems to work fine. Then, and it depends on the day that you're doing it, too. On a hot summer day.
There's heat and there's humidity that make a difference, right?
So do not be, don't want to rush it. You want to keep things cold. You can put things back and forth out of the refrigerator to keep things cold if you think things are getting a little greasy, because flaky lard and flaky butter put in between the flour is really important. So like I said, cup and three quarter cups flour, a pinch of salt, 8 tablespoons of shortening, which is the overall category here. Now, you need to add some sort of liquid, and in a plain...
Now, do you put any sugar in it?
Yes, depending on what my pie is going to be. Yes,
okay.
I do. Okay. Depending on what my pie is going to be, if I want just a flaky crust, or maybe I'm going to make a galette, and we'll talk about that later. And my mom used to do this, so this is the liquid that I add. One egg.
Oh, an egg in the pie crust. Okay, okay.
A teaspoon of vinegar, and we'll tell you why.
Oh, my.
And then about 5 tablespoons, a shy quarter cup of cold water. Make that cold water, folks. Not ice cubes, but cold water. It really helps. And using the pastry cutter, take all of these liquid things, and I could add a little pinch of sugar to that.
So do you mix the water and the vinegar together and then put them in?
I put water, vinegar, and the egg in a little bowl, and I beat that.
The egg is quite whipped.
Egg is quite whipped, yes.
That's not just the yolk, the whole thing.
I use the whole thing.
Okay.
Although, looking in other recipes, the yolk is used.
There's so many variables.
Several variables.
Now the other question is, what size of egg do you use?
Because I know what my pie crust, what my pie pans look like, I tend to go for a small egg because I have my own chickens, and there's always one chicken that is kind of smaller than the rest. If all you have is big eggs, I would suggest just using the egg yolk. You need this for...
Okay, and this is a critical... I had a disaster a few weeks ago. I was making cream puffs. And the joy of cooking, which is my standard pâte à choux recipe, called for 5 eggs. And I'm mixing... And you add them one at a time. Mm-hmm. And at the 4th egg, I went, oh my goodness, this batter is too wet already. And of course, I couldn't get the rise that I needed because the eggs were so large that I ended up with too wet of my dough, you know?
Yep, you have to kind of learn as you go and know what
right, there's a visual element to it, and you just have to keep experimenting till you get it right.
And as you are mixing these ingredients together, it might seem a little dry, but you don't want mushy. You want barely holding together because everyone talks about...
Oh, this is after you've...
Yeah, put the liquid in and...
And when you put the liquid in, are you still using the pastry cutter?
No, by that time I turn to a small spoon or a fork.
And then when it's all kind of folded in, then you take your hands and put it in a ball?
Yes.
Okay.
And now, don't overwork it. Just kind of tap it lightly, pour it on the counter.
Right. You don't have to smush it.
Don't smush it because you want... The idea of flakiness here, and I'm going to read a little bit about flakiness from a book called Cookwise by Shirley O. Corrier. This is a book about, not recipes, but work.
Yeah.
Okay. So, flaky. Flaky pastry is made up of delicately crisp, thin layers. Layers of cold, firm, flat surface spacers to keep the dough apart in a hot oven just long enough for the dough to begin to set. And then the fat melts, the steam from the liquid in the dough forms, and it puffs apart. The fat must remain unmelted during the preparation.
Yeah, when you're rolling it and forming it.
So, the idea of rolling out your dough, you have to be careful when you do this.
Right. You want the fat to be small enough. It looks kind of crumbly before you push it into the ball and roll it out.
It looks crumbly, little, it's way smaller than a pea size, a buckwheat groat size.
Yeah, and there is a long tradition of, not so much American, but European, of having a marble surface in the kitchen because marble is cool to the touch. And if you roll your pie crusts out, like a good pastry kitchen in a good restaurant will have a marble rolling top.
A good thing.
Yeah. And some people even use, there are marble rolling pins as well.
Yes.
And there are rolling pins where you can put ice water in the middle of, you know, like a glass rolling pin that you fill. This is all just to keep the temperature cool.
Right.
So and, that the fat does not melt until it is in the oven.
There we go. And as you're rolling out that ball of dough that you can kind of help along with your fingers a little bit, don't just push down hard. Start from the middle. Roll forward, back, out of the middle, and kind of work the dough from the inside to the edges. And there you have it. There you have it. And be sure to have dusted your counter first.
Oh, yes, of course. Or. Did your mother ever use a pastry cloth?
No. Tell us about pastry cloth.
Oh, my mother had one, and she used the same one for years. And, of course, you don't wash it, right? You just kind of shake it out, but you don't want it to get wet because then it turns into a gooey mess. But it's about the size of, certainly big enough to roll out a pie crust or two.
Yeah, a small tea towel.
Maybe 24 by 24 or something like that. And it's made of a fairly thick, probably used to be muslin, basically. Mama always used it. Now, her pie crust, maybe this is why I have more trouble with pie. She was the Crisco generation, right?
Yeah.
I mean, she grew up with lard, but then when Crisco came along, so of course I was not going to use Crisco because it's hydrogenated fat, which we've now learned, you know, 50 years later is not really good for you. So for years I made a butter crust, which can be tough and much harder to work with. Because the good lard was still not, the good lard was not available. So now your paste, and my mother didn't, she put water, but no vinegar and no egg.
The egg, both the egg and the vinegar attack the glutens that are left in the flour and help to make things a little bit softer. So vinegar, a little acid. Some people add lemon juice.
Oh, yeah.
Or anything acidy, and it doesn't have to be much, just a little.
So how much vinegar do you put in a two-crust pie?
Oh, a shy teaspoon.
Shy. Oh, yeah, okay, not much at all.
No, you don't want to taste it, but still, that vinegar. We're talking chemistry here, folks. This is what we...
Isn't it funny how in our generation, pie crust was the one thing we really learned from our mothers?
Yeah, because it is a how-to-do thing. Yes,
well,
it is.
People used to, my mother was not a cake baker, but she could whip out a pie pretty quickly.
Yeah, see? Also, sugar added also helps the gluten-forming proteins bond with the sugar instead of each other.
Oh.
Low-protein flour, again, less
gluten.
That's less
the pastry
gluten.
Flour yeah. is the soft wheat, low-protein flour.
Gluten-forming, if you cut back on the water and use some of these other things like egg or egg yolk.
Right, because the maximum amount of moisture, no matter whether it's vinegar, egg, or water, it has to be very, you can't overdo it.
Nope, otherwise you end up with glue.
It gets gummy and sticky and you can't roll it out.
Yeah. Good.
Now, do you rest... You mix it up and do you rest it in the refrigerator?
I do that when I'm making a galette.
Oh, but not a pie.
Well, I figure what the heck. I can. I mean, I usually bake while I'm doing a lot of other things. Mm-hmm. So letting things rest is a good idea.
So you put it in the ball form. And how long, what's the minimum amount of time you leave it in the refrigerator?
If you want the cool to make a difference, an hour.
An hour, okay.
That's fine. Oh, well. Let's take a short break here and go back to talking about
what else goes put in the pie.
Okay. This is
420 Blackbirds.
Oh, We'll try that too. KHOI, this is Donna in the Kitchen. For more information, go to www.khoifm.org. This is the Donna Lemon Kitchen. We're talking pie crusts here, and I mentioned before, you can once you have this pie crust, there's other things you can do. There's tarts, there's regular pies, there's hand pies. Little pocket pies are kind of the to do thing is in the food magazines lately. And galettes. I like to make galettes, a rustic pie. Don't use a pie pan, you can keep it flat. Think
on a
pizza,
cookie sheet.
On a cookie sheet. Yeah. And here's a perfect use for the
Silpat.
From the Silpat covering, because as good as you make it, it's going to leak a little bit. But a rustic galette is a pie crust that is wrapped up around to kind of make a little dam to hold everything. But it's served as kind of a...
Okay, Lana is using her hands to describe this, and you cannot see this. So I'm going to try to explain this to you. You roll out a flat circular, like pizza size.
Yeah.
Then you put the fruit and the filling, and then you fold the edges up over, so there's still like a 6-inch circle in the middle where you see the fruit, and then there's the crust kind of folded all around the edges. So now.
Yeah, there it is. And that is a...
whole thing is the size of an average pie still.
Right.
Or a little...
A little bigger. A little bit, because it can kind of smoosh
up. Yeah, it's more irregular and rustic looking.
Yes, and the galette crust, I often think, well, it needs to be a bit hardier than it doesn't
oh,
have
Oh, because
to.
You have to fold it.
Yeah, I think...
So do you roll it a little thicker
a little
than a pie?
Thicker.
A little thicker,
and
okay.
I may, and in that flour, in the flour, I may add or substitute maybe a quarter cup of something else, as in whole wheat flour, as in... really fine cornmeal, that works lovely.
Oh, and it makes the crust less delicate and it'll
fold
you bend the edges over?
Yeah, I find that. You don't want this to be yes, you want flaky, but you want, this is a hearty pie.
Right, you don't want it to fall apart the second the fork hits it.
And this is a good opportunity when you get it on the cookie sheet to let it rest in the refrigerator and chill up all those butter and lard bits in there. Let that be chilled.
So you chill it after you roll it?
After I roll it, put it in the refrigerator, wait an hour, then come out and assemble it.
Okay, are you chilling it twice or you're only chilling it in the rolled-out stage?
Just chilling it in the rolled-out stage.
Okay, very good to know. Folks, this is a technique I have not tried myself. So I am going to... I'm inspired,
go.
Lana.
Well, let's talk about other stuff to put in a pie, Donna.
Well, it's rhubarb season.
All right, have at it.
Well, do you, on your filling for the galette, because it's free form and it doesn't have a pan to hold it, are you using the same thing that you would put in a regular pie pan?
Yes, you need some sort of thing to hold things together, as in cornstarch or flour. So think of making a regular pie in but not in a dish.
Okay, so the last one I had of yours was a
apricot.
Right. She's got apricots up the wazoo in her freezer. It's quite a pleasure. So you put the apricots in the bowl, and how much fruit volume-wise do you want for a pie this size with this recipe?
I do it all by eyeball.
What do you think? Two cups?
2 cups.
Three cups?
It's the size of a regular pie, so 2 cups.
Yeah. Okay, 2 cups. Mm-hmm. And then tapioca, cornstarch, what do you put?
I like cornstarch.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
And do you mix it? I mix my cornstarch with the sugar so I don't get any little glumps in it.
Yes, yes. And mix it well with the fruit before you put it in. So again, glumps, that's a technical term. You don't want those.
No glumps in your pie. And then seasonings besides sugar. With apricots, you just did apricots and sugar, right?
Oh, I think I did a shake of cardamom just for the heck of it.
Ooh, yeah. Ooh. Yeah, that's a good time to add in those flavors.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm going to have an experiment with my rhubarb, and maybe I'll make a rhubarb galette. I picked some rhubarb from the garden yesterday. It's the first picking. And I've got it in the counter all cleaned up and ready to go. So what I think I'm going to do is you have to have sugar. Now, a classic with rhubarb is nutmeg, but I'm going to leave that out. I'm just going to do sugar. And I have a new little trick that I'm trying. We've probably talked about yuzu before. So yuzu is a Japanese citrus. If you've ever eaten at a good sushi restaurant, they will usually have some yuzu. It's not that easy to find outside of large urban environments or in California. I think in California they planted a lot of yuzu trees and they did not do well there. So yuzu in the fresh form, which is, of course, its most delightful, is very, very hard to find.
It's citrus.
Yeah.
It's a citrus.
It's not quite like lemon. And the main part that is used is actually the peel and the zest. Mm. So there are two ways to get yuzu right here in the middle of the Midwest. And one we've talked about before is to buy at an Asian store something they called citrus tea or something like that. It's basically yuzu marmalade, just like orange marmalade, but it has yuzu. So that gets you a yuzu flavor, which I have used in pies and cakes and other things. But my latest discovery is that, sorry to say, but Amazon has a dried flaked yuzu powder. So I am going to try. You know how you can put, Lana makes a jelly with orange peel and rhubarb. I'm going to use some of the yuzu powder in my rhubarb. And I will let you know.
That combination is really good.
So, yeah, the yuzu butter, it comes in, I don't know, it's a little package and it's a dried powder. I did some things like I made a compounded butter where I put one stick of butter, let it soften, put in 2 teaspoons of yuzu powder and blended it really well, then put it in a jar and refrigerated and just put it on my toast every day. Love yuzu.
Love
yuzu. Y-U-Z-U.
Good. And that sounds like it's a good experiment with rhubarb. It's time for rhubarb pie. Traditionally in the Midwest, we tend to put strawberries with it or apples or whatever.
No strawberries yet.
Not yet. Raw rhubarb is 94% water, 5% carbohydrates, and 1% protein. Okay? It is a rich source of vitamin K and a moderate source of vitamin C. And yes, the rhubarb is tasty, but do not eat the leaves because they're poisonous.
Yeah.
I mean, like, not knock you over.
They'll make your tummy feel terrible.
Yes, it is pretty, it's pretty not so
good. Yeah, so just eat the stalks, which are abundant right now.
Yeah.
And, okay, rhubarb pie question, Lana. If I want to make a galette with your recipe, since the rhubarb is so wet, how much cornstarch should I put? More?
I'd put, in a pie size, maybe 2 tablespoons of cornstarch.
Tablespoons?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think, I don't know how when it's going to be, but yeah.
Okay,
a trick with galette, if you're dealing with fruit out of the freezer, it's already kind of wet and mushy already.
Yep.
I drain it and add cornstarch to the liquid, warm that up a little bit so it gets, and make sure that the liquid has lots of cornstarch, and then put it back together.
And do you put the sugar with the cornstarch? How do you keep it from glumping?
Glumping, I cook it a little bit in the, warm it up in the sugar with the cornstarch.
Sugar again. Oh. So mixing sugar and cornstarch is a good way to make sure you don't have lumps in it.
Very good. Remember that.
Little trick.
That should be a bumper sticker.
Yes,
it is. Oh, very good. Well, we talked about flowers and early morning harvest and pie crusts and rhubarb today. Yes. Donna, tell the world about our new project. We have a new podcast.
Yes, our show, which we make once a week, and we will continue to be a radio show, and we will continue to be in the places where we have been for 8 years, but we also have a new format called a podcast. So you can go to wherever you get podcasts, whether it's Spotify or Apple or whatever, and if you type in Donna Lonna, which is one word, D-O-N-N-A-L-O-N-N-A, kitchen, separate word, you will find the Donna Lonna Kitchen Podcast.
There you go.
Which is, and it's the same show that we do on the radio. It's just a different place so people can find it all over the world if they want.
Oh, how exciting.
Oh, yes.
Oh, we are learning new tricks. We are learning. Oh, I have a poem to share. Mary Oliver is a fine poet, and this is from her book called A Thousand Mornings, Poems by Mary Oliver. This poem is called The Way of the World. The chickens ate all the crickets. The fox ate all the chickens. This morning, a friend hauled his boat to shore and gave me the most wondrous fish. Its silver scale deemed it dressed for a wedding. The gills were pulsing just above where the shoulders would be if it had shoulders. The eyes were still looking around. I don't know what they were thinking. The chickens ate all the crickets. The fox ate all the chickens. I ate the fish. That poem by Mary Oliver. There we go. Oh, I have a recommendation. I ran across a really nice show on Iowa PBS, a television program, and it's called My Garden of a Thousand Bees. And a wildlife cameraman sets out to film all the bees he found in his urban garden in Bristol, England. It's fascinating.
Right, we all think a bee is a bee, except for, of course, a wasp and a yellow jacket, but there are so many kinds of wild bees.
It was a good thing, and it's called My Garden of a Thousand Bees. What a good thing. What a good thing. Oh, here's an upcoming event. Mustard Seed Farm is having a plant sharing event Saturday, May 14th, 10 to noon. Rest of the noon hour there at the Romero House, 709 Clark Avenue. Swap your seeds, swap your plants. Mustard Seed Farm, they do good things. You've been listening to the Donna Lonna Kitchen. You can find us here every Tuesday at noon, repeated at 7 p.m., or on podcast, too. Support this fine radio station, KHOI. We had music by the Barn Owl Band today. Go ahead. Make a pie. It's spring. My name is Lonna Noctical.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had excellent engineering by Eric Blocker. Eat good food and enjoy life.